We go to the phone. Our guest is here, Joe Walsh, former Tea Party congressman from the great state of Illinois. Joe was also a national conservative broadcaster until he turned on Trump. He's now the host of the White Flag podcast. Joe Walsh, welcome back to WICC.
Joe, I'm a bum. I apologize. I'm a half an hour late.
It is, you know what, for you, sir, it is okay. It is okay. Sometimes you get to the party.
Man. Good to be.
Joe, sometimes you get to the party a little late.
I know, but I don't like to be rude, and I like to be on your show, so thank you, my friend.
No, absolutely my pleasure. I had a little bit prepared. You know, I always have to back up a bit just in case, so it was good to be able to throw that out there. I want to start off, we got to talk about, you know, you've been one of the few guys on the right, one of the few conservatives to show any sort of integrity. I'm just curious your thoughts on that garbage that Tucker Carlson aired on Fox News.
Hey Joe, I've been more sad and worried for our country this week than I was the week of January 6th. What Tucker Carlson has done is so dishonest and so dangerous, but it's the reaction to what Tucker's done, Joe, from everybody I've heard from on the right. They all believe it now. They're convinced now that January 6th was not a bad day, was not a bad thing. And that's a really, really bad thing for this country.
Yeah, the other shocking thing that came out of all this, you know, I've told you this, I take a lot of flack from my audience here because I don't like Trump, but I'm honest about it. We've now found out Tucker Carlson privately hates Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's the least shocking thing we learned all week. hey, Joe, I came out publicly against Trump 6 years ago. If I had a dollar for every one of my former Republican colleagues and every one of my former right-wing talk colleagues who privately told me they agreed with everything I said publicly against Trump, I'd be a wealthy dude.
Yeah.
We all know this. We all know that Republicans, Republican elected officials, and even most Republican media people, they can't stand him. They want him gone. But they've always been way too afraid to say that publicly because, you know, you want to keep your job. You want to keep your show. You want to keep your audience. You want to keep your ratings. You want to get reelected. So they keep quiet.
And yet, but he seems so vulnerable right now. Like Trump, this seems like the time where if they wanted to get rid of him, now would be the time. Again, are they just that scared of losing that base?
Yes. It's not Trump. It's the voters. I mean, think about it, Joe. If you're going to challenge Trump for the Republican nomination in 24, all these people who might challenge him, none of them are going to criticize Trump. I mean, think about that for a minute. You're going to run against Donald Trump because you think you should be the Republican nominee for president, yet you're afraid to criticize him. And they won't. And DeSantis won't. None of them will because they're afraid of his voters, and they don't want to lose his voters.
You served with Steve Scalise. You said on Twitter that you know he doesn't believe what Tucker Carlson put out there was a good thing. You said he knows January 6th is a horrible attack against our government. He suggested it was Nancy Pelosi and the January 6th commission that did the cherry picking, not Tucker Carlson. Talking with a former Tea Party congressman from the great state of Illinois, a former national conservative radio host, one of my favorites. Then he came out against Trump, lost the gig. He's now the host of the White Flag podcast. Joe Walsh, always love talking to you, man.
Well, thank you, Joe, because like you, I just generally just say what's on my mind. Fire away.
Right. All right. So you served with Steve Scalise. You know him very well. Guys like Jim Jordan was a good buddy of yours. My question is, what are these guys doing? Is this about power? Is this them possibly being compromised, or are they literally just scared?
It's different with everyone, Joe. Scalise is a good man. He's not a crazy. You know, people ask me all the time about these Republicans. Most of them are not crazy, and they don't believe all this conspiratorial crap. Marjorie Taylor Greene is crazy. My former buddy Jim Jordan believes it. You could call him crazy. Steve Scalise isn't. He represents most Republicans. They're scared to death of the crazies because, Joe, the crazies represent the most engaged Republican voter out there. I always say this. Marjorie Taylor Greene represents today's Republican Party way better than Nikki Haley does or Mitt Romney does. It's not even close.
And yet, here in the state of Connecticut, Joe, the head of the Republican Party in Connecticut, Ben Proto, Connecticut, it was a blowout. It wasn't even close. The Republicans and all the statewide offices got destroyed. The state legislature got bluer, despite the state of the economy, despite the high crime, despite everything. And he is under the impression it's the moderates, the moderate Republicans are the reason why they did so poorly in the election. And I think to myself, is this guy out of his mind? Who is he trying to convince? It's certainly not the moderates. You know, it's definitely the extremists. And, you know, they like to chalk up the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Lauren Boberts. It's like, well, you know, you guys got AOC and Bernie and, you know, we've got these couple of lunatics. But I think it's more like you said, it's more the pervasive face of the Republican Party at this point.
Yeah, when I was there, when I was in Congress 8, 9, 10 years ago, Joe, Marjorie Taylor Greene would have been fringe. Look, when I was in Congress, Mr. Tea Party, I was considered one of the crazies.
Right.
I probably was. But what's happened is the party has continued to move crazier and crazier. Trump came along, and now, as I say often, the party now is fully radicalized. So Marjorie Taylor Greene is now mainstream Republican Party. And damn it, I'm so tired of Democrats not recognizing this. You better recognize it. Don't laugh at it. And or Joe, there's a decent chance Trump could become president again.
Yeah. And it's a really scary notion. You know, for the last 4 or 5 years now, I have constantly called out my senators here from Connecticut, Blumenthal and Murphy, nice guys, always on Twitter. They were always complaining about how we had to stop Trump. And I thought to myself, isn't that what you guys are there for? It seemed to me like the Democrats just increasingly are constantly looking at us and like, hey, what are we going to do? And it's like, well, I don't know. Do something. There's going to be something you guys can do. I can't believe Fox News can continue to put out the kind of information that they put out in the midst of being sued by Dominion, that they would allow Tucker Carlson to air something so dishonest to their audience while they're literally in court defending their credibility. Like, that is crazy. Where are we as a country that there's no mechanism to stop this from continuing after all this?
Where are we as a country? We have not been this divided as a country since just before the Civil War. Take that, Joe, as you'd like to take it. Look, this is serious, serious stuff. We love to talk about how off the rails my former political party is, and they are. The Democratic Party has their own problems, and they've got big, big problems. I'm not a Democrat. I spend all of my time, it seems, going after my former party because they're such a threat to our democracy. But the Democrats, man, they're in trouble, man. They are dependent upon an 80-year-old guy who would be 82 if he's reelected to keep them in the White House. They've got their own problems. This country's really, really divided. And I don't know. Well, I do know, like, you know, Joe, the only way we get out of this is we speak to each other. It's like the country's on the verge of a divorce, Joe.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know. I've been married twice. I've undergone marriage, marital therapy, right?
Yep.
This country needs some marital therapy.
I mean, we're at the point where, yeah, I mean, if you want to go with that analogy, where it's like two different realities, you know, where the wife says, you're not fulfilling my needs. And you're like, well, you're not fulfilling mine. And we're not even on the same page at all, where we can't even look at something on video, watch it, and I'll agree. Yeah, OK, we just saw what happened, that we could watch 41,000 hours of video and come to very different conclusion. It is such a scary thought. You called the Republican Party radicalized. I'm sure you got a lot of pushback on that. If I can have you for about 8 more minutes, Joe, we got to take another quick break. I want to know exactly what you mean by radicalized, and I want you to explain it to this audience, because I don't think anybody's going to question your conservative card, right? They know who you are. And so I want you to get into that.
I'm still a crazy Tea Party guy, Joe. I'm still the crazy Tea Party.
Yes! You're supposed to be the crazy Tea Party guy, and now it's like you're pretty mainstream compared to some of these people. It's nuts. Talking to former Tea Party congressman from Illinois, former national conservative radio host until he came out against Donald Trump. He hosts the White Flag podcast, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Joe Walsh, great to have you here. Before I let you go again, I just want to get into this. You said, and earlier you actually, you said that your former party is a threat to democracy. And I know a lot of Republicans who will sort of chalk that up to hyperbole when a libtard says it. So I think it hits different when they hear it coming from a real conservative like Joe Walsh. So, Joe, explain to this audience what you mean by this party has become radicalized.
Well, and it comes, Joe, from me, somebody who comes from the base. I come from the Republican Party base. What I mean by radicalized is this. Republican voters no longer believe in truth. They've given up on democracy. They want a dictator, a strong man to rule them. And they don't want to just beat their political opponents. They want to destroy them. Mm-hmm. Look, the Republican Party base, Joe, they want 1954 America back. They want the America back where they're, you know, this was mostly a white country, a Christian country, and men were men, women were women, and men married women, and women married men, and you could say Merry Christmas and all the rest. They don't believe anymore that the democratic process, elections, can get them that America back. So they want a son of a bitch. They want an authoritarian like a Trump or a DeSantis to get it back for them. And Joe, the final point is, when I say radicalized, they're completely untethered to truth. Most Republicans do not believe Joe Biden won. Most Republicans believe the vaccines are bad. And I'd argue most Republicans believe January 6th was perfectly good.
Yeah, I think, you know, the last time we talked, Joe, you said, and this was, I had to deal with this after you and I hung up. I said, is there any chance of straightening this out, of this Republican Party getting back on track? And you and I are, I think, roughly the same age. You said, not in my lifetime. And I thought, oh, no, that's my lifetime, too. We're in real trouble here. Is there a chance that if DeSantis runs against Trump, do you think Trump runs third party? Does he run as an independent?
What we know about Trump is this. Donald Trump only cares about Donald Trump. So if DeSantis would run, and if somebody besides Trump got the nomination, there's no way Trump will support that nominee. Will he run as an independent? Who knows? But he will try to make life hell for whoever the Republican nominee is, Joe, and that will work with a lot of his supporters. Look, I think the Republican Party is on the train track it's on. I don't think it's going to change. We're at a weird point in history where I really think in the next 4 to 6 to 8 to 10 years, we will see a viable third party and maybe a viable fourth party. We are living in revolutionary times. That's cool.
Why don't you start a party, a real conservative party? And I would do anything I could to help you get that launched if you were ever to do that.
I'll make you a deal, Joe. I'll make you a deal. You find me about $400 to $500 million, and I will go out tomorrow and start that. I'll start that common sense, radically centrist, let's get stuff done party.
I'm going to start crowdfunding today, and I'll call you when we get to the money, because, boy, do we need this. You know, here's another thing. I think you had tweeted something about this a day or so ago. Trump, in an interview, said he would have given parts of Ukraine to Russia And Fox News literally edited out Trump saying that. Again, Fox News, credibility-wise, is... And maybe the audience just doesn't care that they're being lied to. I think maybe that's the bigger problem here. People like my mom don't think they're being lied to. And so I feel like every time they get busted in another one of these things, it only helps. Because I think at some point, Joe, again, you mentioned having been married twice. I'm married twice. I said when I got married a second time, I would not let someone lie to me. If I knew the person was lying, I wasn't going to let that happen like I did the first time through. And things have gone much better the second time. I feel
hey,
like,
Joe,
yeah.
No, you're saying it. You know. You cannot lie repeatedly. You cannot lie repeatedly to somebody you like and respect. So there's no way Tucker Carlson likes or respects his audience. There's no way Donald Trump likes or respects his voters. There's no way stupid Sean Hannity likes and respects his audience. You can't lie to people like that and like them. Now, like your mom, like a lot of people I know, most Fox News listeners, watchers don't know they're being lied to or don't care.
Yeah, that's the worst part. It's the probably don't care part. You know, like you said, having that authoritative figure in your life who's going to take care of everything and destroy your opposition. Well, boy, I guess I just got to sit back and just nod along. And I suppose that's the proposition that I feel bad because I know there's a lot of good Republican out there who truly do feel like the Democrats are out to destroy America. And again, right-wing media and again, increasingly the politicians are beating that dead horse to where you hear the lies over and over again. You just take it all in, you believe it, and that becomes your reality. That's where we are, and man, we are in some serious trouble.
We are. We are. And it's going to be, and Joe, it's going to be ugly and rough and bumpy and probably violent for a while. This great, good, decent thing called America, can we keep it together? That's the question, and I don't know the answer.
You know, Joe, and I know you know this, but I mean, the great democracies in history, in about 250 years or so, and that's generally about all you get, and we're at that mark. How serious do you think a civil war type situation in the future could be here?
I don't know what it will look like. And Joe, here's like Marjorie Taylor Greene a few weeks ago said we need a national divorce. Mm-hmm. Man, I was asking that question like 8 or 9 years ago. Can we stay together? But there's this whole blue state, red state, blue state thing is a bunch of crap. The divide in the country is not state by state. You know, Joe, it's
right.
Urban and rural. I come from Illinois. You're in Connecticut, two solidly blue states. But you go out into rural Connecticut and you go into southern Illinois, you're in a different country.
Right.
So it's an urban and rural divide. I don't know how it's going to play out, but the divide is real. And the left and Democrats need to understand that and not just laugh when Marjorie Taylor Greene says what she says.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I've been feeling like the Democrats just don't take this seriously enough. And I think it's a big part of the reason why we've gotten to where we've gotten. Joe Walsh, a little bit late, but awesome as always. Much appreciated. Always love talking to former Tea Party Congressman Joe Walsh. Again, his podcast is called White Flag. You got to check it out anywhere you download your podcasts. Joe, I appreciate
you.
You
rock, Joe. You rock, my friend. You rock. Great to be with you always, Joe. Thank you, buddy.
Much appreciated. Joe Walsh, everybody. My next guest, Mark Perlman, is the author of the historical novel, The Reluctant Soldier. He is a Connecticut resident, born in the Bronx, grew up in northern New Jersey. He went to college at Northeastern University in Boston. And so, Mark, first of all, thank you for being here. Second, I have to ask you, how did you become an expert in the utilization of black troops during World War I? How did that happen?
Well, that's a very good question. I do want to say hello to you and your listeners out there, first of all. And thank you for having me on.
My pleasure.
Well, the 369th Infantry Regiment, whose nom de guerre is referred to as the Harlem Hellfighters, was one of the most accomplished units in the history of American military for, you know, going back over 200 years. And their story is pretty largely forgotten, although there has been books written on them, documentaries, etc. When I was doing my research about the unit, both in the States and in France, I came across political differences and cultural and norm differences between how the African American soldiers were treated in the American Army versus the ones that were deployed by the French Army and to some extent the British Army. So that had an impact on me. And in doing this research, I became knowledgeable about these differences, and as a result, that was part of my writing of this historical novel. I didn't want to make it just monofaceted. I made it a multifaceted book that would appeal to a broader audience. Specifically, it's not just about World War One, although that does take up a decent percentage of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to make sure that the reader had a sympathetic view of the protagonist, Virgil Carpenter,
yep,
as he grew up and made his way through France in the war, and also the cultural differences between America and France, and that he stayed in Paris after the First World War, what happened to him in terms of the cultural changes like the jazz phenomenon and his solving of murder cases with his French detective that he was befriended by after the war. So without dragging the answer out a whole lot, I did by accident become pretty prolific in the politics and the pragmatics of the utilization of the African-American troops.
How shocking was that, Mark, to see the contrast between the two? Or maybe,
well,
it wasn't.
I mean, it wasn't that shocking. I mean, I knew that, you know, 100-plus years ago, you know, I knew the military was segregated. It wasn't desegregated until President Truman in 1948. But there were biases, certainly, mostly in the South, but maybe elsewhere, that didn't want the African-American or troops of color, let me call them troops of color, to fight alongside their white American counterparts. In fact, of the 200,000 troops of color in France during the Great War, about 20% actually fought. The other 80% were in labor duties, like stevedores, railroad, grave site laborers. It's a good thing the 369th, which was a National Guard unit in Harlem, did combat and performed extremely well. But they have performed extremely well under the command of the French Army. The headquarters of the American Expeditionary Force in France, headed by General John Pershing, known as Blackjack Pershing, he handed off a number of regiments to the French Army because they were in desperate need of troops, any color at all. They,
mm-hmm.
They were in bad shape. They were in bad shape. So they were treated very well under the French. The French had no, of course, the French had their own colonial troops from Senegal, from West Africa, from Morocco. So they were used to working with and commanding troops of all color throughout the different continents.
So interesting. We are talking to author Mark Perlman, who wrote the historical novel The Reluctant Soldier. Mark, one of the things about this novel, and I apologize, I usually read a book before I interview an author, but I went through, I know this story pretty well, and it looks absolutely fascinating to me. One of the things that you've done with this book, again, it is fictional, but Ernest Hemingway and Josephine Baker are amongst the historical figures that Virgil interacts with. I love stories like this, fictional stories that have those elements of fact. Can you talk about why you chose the people you chose, or was it just more or less people associated with that time frame?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. Well, Virgil had the good fortune to have his college bankrolled. That's part of the book is very relevant, and he gets a college education, and he makes his way to New York City and teaches there, and he teaches English literature. So he does have a bailiwick for the English language and English literature. Eventually, he makes his way over to France, and in doing so, he comes upon a bookstore, an English bookstore, catering to Americans and people from England that are in Paris, and he meets with the owner, Sylvia Beach, who originally came from New Jersey but opened up a bookstore called Shakespeare and Company, which still exists on the left bank of Paris today. And her bookstore was a focal point for the literaries that were in Paris. Literaries like, as you mentioned, Ernest Hemingway, James Joyce. In fact, his book, Ulysses, which is a classic, was published by none other than Sylvia Beach, who was the bookstore owner. A book that was banned in many cities and countries. Ford, Maddox Ford, and other literary luminaries congregated there. And then he met other literary people like Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, her partner, and others. And so his interactions are woven through the historical relevance of these people right after World War One. So I had to be very, you know, the research caused me to be extremely factual and not play around with the realities that were these individuals.
Mark Perlman, author of The Reluctant Soldier, is our guest. And Mark, I've seen two different numbers here. One said you spent 10 years. The other one says you spent 15 years doing research for this book. Can you, for people who have never written a book and don't understand, what is that process like? And at least a decade of research, like it's a real commitment.
Well, it is. I was working at the time, so I had another life that, you know, I was, I was earning money to feed my family. So, but, you know, I did have time to go on vacation, and I spent part of it in France a number of times. When you're doing a non-fictional book or a historical fiction, if you're writing about real events and real people, it takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so I did spend a lot of time both in France, in Belgium, in Germany, in the United States, doing research when I could. When I could. So it took a 10-year period of time, part-time. There were months I didn't do anything. But, you know, it was a lot of research, and it took a couple of years to write. It took almost that long to have it edited and adapted, because the book is not only in English, but it is in French.
Yep.
And So that takes a while. And once it gets published, then, you know, you have to promote it. Promoting a book for a relative unknown is a lot of work. And so I do spend a lot of time promoting my book through speaking events at fraternal organizations, libraries, interviews like this, and other venues. And that's been very helpful to get the word out and to tell the story.
Well, I can't wait to tear into this book and read it. TheReluctantSoldier.com is the website. You can also purchase this book on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Where could they find you social media-wise, Mark?
Yeah, thank you. As you said, my website is www.TheReluctantSoldier.com. The book can be, the paperback can be purchased in English or French. On the website, I would sign the book and send it right off to the individual. Just takes a few days to get. That's the only place you can get the French version is through my website. Also, there are free articles. People call them blogs these days.
Yep.
I like to think of them as articles, but there are free articles. Like one is the Spanish flu pandemic and the Great War. Another one is spiritualism, seances, and the Great War. So there's a number of articles I write once a month for free, anyone that's visiting the website. Also, if someone visits the website and they're part of an organization like the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, a church, a library, and they might be interested in having me speak, all they have to do is go to the website, put in the email section, and I will respond to that individual.
And you live here in Connecticut.
Yeah, I live in Fairfield.
Perfect.
And the book, as you said, can be purchased in English, either in paperback or ebook. I know there are some people that only like ebook, and they can purchase that on Amazon.
Awesome. Mark Perlman, again, can't wait to read the book. It looks really awesome. I appreciate all the work that you put into this thing. Thank you so much for your time, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you, Joe. I really appreciate you having me, and I wish you all the best.
Same to you. My pleasure. My next guest wasn't a huge fan of this guy. I mean, as a human being, I am, but as a Yankees fan, when I think of the name Bronson Arroyo, two things come to mind. The first is Alex Rodriguez trying to slap a ball out of Bronson Arroyo's glove. It was just And the other one is Arroyo threw a pitch, hit A-Rod. You've all seen the video. You might not even remember who the pitcher was that day. That's the one where Jason Veritek shoves A-Rod by the face. He's also, and this is another one, you associate this name very much with the Boston Red Sox. He was a 2004 World Series champion. But also, Bronson Arroyo, welcome to WICC, and congratulations, Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame inductee.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Joe. Thanks, man.
Dude, that is so cool. I literally was just looking up your numbers, and I forgot, I mean, 9 really good years you had there in Cincinnati. I almost forgot about that.
Yeah, you know, it's when I left Boston, I came to Cincy and I was disappointed by the trade because, you know, playing in that rivalry with the Yankees was just, you felt like it was the pinnacle of the sport. You felt like you were in the center of the universe. And coming over to Cincy, I hadn't paid attention to the National League for a while. But, you know, I got off to a great start in 06, became an All-Star that year, you know, and fell in love with the city after that. And now to be able to go into the Hall of Fame, sitting next to Johnny Bench, Pete Rose, you know, Joe Morgan, guys that I admired as a kid and also became friends with in my time playing here is just absolutely remarkable.
Brunson, I got to say, you've lived a pretty amazing life. I think, too, of one of my favorite baseball players, Bernie Williams, who, much like you, in addition to being an all-star and a really great all-around baseball player, has a passion for music. You kind of grew up in it, right? Both your mom and dad were musical people.
Yeah, my grandmother was a music teacher for about 7 decades down in Key West, and there was people always coming in and out of the house as a kid. They were rehearsing for orchestras and people learning the cello and the violin and the piano and My parents, like you said, were playing. My father was always singing in bands and stuff. So it had been around, but I didn't really get the bug myself for it until like those early 90s albums started coming out of Seattle. Stone Temple Pilots, Nirvana, yeah. Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. That stuff really turned me on. So while I was in the minor leagues, I picked up an acoustic guitar and just slowly started kind of hacking away at it. And just like Bernie, you know, Bernie's more schooled and trained than I am because he's a jazz musician and it's a little bit more theory. But, you know, we both just have a passion for it. And that's why, you know, these days you can show up at a festival somewhere and you might see me and Bernie on the stage together. You know, two guys that played against each other all those years.
How awesome. I'll say this, and I've always been very impressed with Bernie Williams, not necessarily a jazz guy. Your music is my wheelhouse. When my producer booked his interview, he was very excited. Bronson Arroyo. I'm like, yeah, great. He pointed out to me, and I didn't know about this, but back in 05, you did an album. Your first album was called Covering the Bases, and it was like a 90s alt-rock greatest hits album. It's all covers, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. When did you? I'm assuming that's an off-season thing?
That one I did, yeah, the off-season of 04, I had a producer call me and ask me if I wanted to actually write songs, and I just didn't feel like I was seasoned enough at the time to write, and also after winning that World Series, it was just chaos, going everywhere, taking the trophy and stuff, so I said, sure, I'll come in if I can just do cover out songs, and so that's why that album was just, you know, kind of my favorite 12 songs from the 90s, just growing up and listening to that stuff and playing with some of the best musicians on the planet. That was the inception of me starting to play live as well, which was going to start peeling back these layers of getting used to being a musician on stage.
We're talking to former Red Sox and Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame pitcher Bronson Arroyo. Again, we're talking about his 2005 album, Covering the Bases. It was all 90s alt-rock covers. Just an unbelievable list of songs on there. Let's talk about Bronson Arroyo and the 04. That is the name of your band. Guys have a new album out called Some Might Say. It's available now on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, wherever you download music. Is this is finally you. These are songs that you've written, Bronson. Is that correct?
Yeah. Every one of these stories came out of my mind. You know, I went out to Los Angeles after I retired in 2017, and I've been friends with these guys since 04. That's why the band is called the 04. You know, it's four guys playing behind me, but we're all friends since that year, and we've always played charity events together. Peter Gammons and Theo Epstein would put on a thing called Hot Stove Cool Music every year in New England, and we'd always raise some money playing charity. And we would do a lot of times just playing cover songs, you know. But we had in the back of our mind we were going to write a record, I think, at some time, and I got the itch to try and finish these songs. So I went out to L.A. I grabbed some riffs from the guys out of their old iPhones, wrote some myself, came to Cincinnati, and just hacked away at this for about a year and a half, and finally had about, you know, 24 songs to choose from on a record, and we cut 13 of them, and, you know, 10 made the record. But these are all stories out of my brain, and no one else was in the studio with us except for an engineer. So this is produced by the guys in the band, recorded by the guys in the band, written by the guys in the band from top to bottom.
The Boston Globe describes the album as a collection of 10 guitar-driven songs that bring to mind Pearl Jam or Tom Petty. And I got to tell you, those are two of my, I mean, again, like anybody who grew up in the 90s, late 90s, if you haven't heard Bronson Arroyo's music yet, you're totally missing out, man. You have the jam down. And you also, Bronson, I got to say this. I remember you had the big leg kick, and I play in a wiffle ball league, and it's very much a Bronson Arroyo slash another Cincinnati Red, Rob Dibble. I go with a really high leg kick. I've always loved the high leg kick on that. But you look like an alt rocker. You always kind of have.
Yeah, you know, I grew the hair out in 2004, really, because in 03, Kevin Millar made us shave our heads that year during the playoffs. And so I was like, I'm going to see what happens when I grow this thing out and put the cornrows in, and then I just kept letting it grow. But since then, yeah, you know, it's like these days I'm living the lifestyle of a musician in a lot of ways. You know, you think about yourself as a musician and not so much an athlete anymore because you're playing music a lot more often. But, you know, a lot of that early 90s stuff is just, it feels like my sweet spot. You know, we played a nice set out in Arizona the other day at Innings Festival, and we got to play at 2:30 in the afternoon. And, you know, guys like Dontrell Willis and Luis Gonzalez are out there, you know, teaching pitching and stuff, and we're playing a nice set for some people. And then jumped up on stage and played Black with Eddie Vedder, you know, at the end of the night. And it's just like, you know, these are the things that I dreamt about as a kid, not only winning the World Series, but, you know, playing next to a guy like Eddie Vedder, and as I've gotten more seasoned musically, it feels like, you know, I can stand on the stage next to some of these giants and feel good about what I'm putting out in the world.
Yeah, well, you should be very proud of yourself. You also have another festival, Innings Festival, coming up in Tampa, Florida on the 19th at Raymond James Stadium. Imagine Dragons, Pitbull, Dave Matthews Band, Third Eye Blind. Again, some of my favorite bands. And, of course, Bronson Arroyo and the 04. And by the way, so people know, right, your band is pretty legit. I mean, these guys have played with some pretty big names themselves.
Yeah, Jamie Aronson, my guitar player, is American Hi-Fi was his original band out of college, and he's been playing with Miley Cyrus for the last 15 years. But Eric Gardner, the drummer, is playing with Melissa Etheridge right now, and Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, and Clint Walsh, the other guitar player, you know, played with the Motels and played with Johnny Holiday and played with Gnarls Barkley. And, you know, these guys have been for the last 30 years performing as true musicians, but it's also, you know, a bunch of guys that I would throw batting practice to in the off season. So it was like, you know, it's a perfect pairing of guys who yeah. you know, are quality enough to bring my songs to life, but also feel like a band of brothers and not just like a bunch of hired guns.
Bronson, I really appreciate the time. Bronson Arroyo and the 04. Again, the album is called Some Might Say. It's available now. You can download it at Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, and more. You can also check him out on Facebook at Bronson Arroyo Band and on Instagram, Bronson Arroyo 61. Dude, so great to talk to you. Continued success with the rock career, and can't wait to jam out to some of this music. What an honor talking to you. Bronson Arroyo, a 2023 Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame inductee. So, again, congratulations on that, Bronson.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely my pleasure. My next guests, Alexis Harrison of Fairfield and Maria Weingarten of New Canaan. They're the founders of CT169 Strong. It's a grassroots group dedicated to informing residents on zoning policies impacting local control and empowering our towns. They're all volunteers. Alexis is a member of the Fairfield Town Plan and Zoning Commission. Maria is a member of the New Canaan Board of Finance. Ladies, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Joe. Good to talk to you.
Great to have you on here. You know, as I was just saying before we came on, we have a serious housing problem here in the great state of Connecticut. And I know you guys are very concerned about some of these bills and, you know, the state sort of trying to tell local zoning boards what to do. That kind of stuff doesn't generally go over well.
Yeah, and I also think we have to be careful when we use the word housing crisis. You know, we don't really have exact numbers of what the crisis really entails. We get numbers from housing advocates who are obviously pushing one agenda. You know, we know that poverty, I think, in Connecticut is pretty low right now. The population is going down. So I just think we really need to get an accurate picture of what the housing crisis looks like.
So,
but yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, and tomorrow, right, their testimony will be happening in the Planning and Development Committee at 11 o'clock.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And CT169, Charles, we've been following and fighting against, you know, bad zoning policies that have been coming forth for the last three sessions, very onerous bills that really take away local control of our land, which is problematic for me. I sit on the TP&Z in Fairfield. And, you know, our zoning boards are, you know, we know the nuances of our community. We're in the best position to make decisions when it comes to zoning. I also want to say, you know, zoning is not the root cause of our economic issues in Connecticut, and it's surely not going to be what solves it. So we really, I think, need to come together, coalesce, and that's when real progress can be made. It can't just be being pushed by one group, like housing advocates and developer lobbyists.
I was looking at the information for CT169 Strong, and I thought it was really cool kind of the way you guys approach this. You point out things in the bills that you liked and then, you know, obviously put also the things that you don't like. So it's not like you're like, I just hate this. You're not only pointing out things that you do like, you're just making suggestions on what would make these bills better for everybody.
Exactly. And that's, I think, the greatest frustration that we have. What, you know, we've been tracking this very closely for the last 3 years. And, you know, when the bills keep coming back with the exact same language over and over and over again, and it's not us saying it. It's the local land use experts who are begging them and testifying in each of these years to say, as of right, development is really not workable for these towns when it comes to multifamily large projects. Every location, every site is different, and that's really important to keep in mind. And so that's one of the biggest issues, is that they keep rehashing bills and they keep putting in no parking, no off-street parking requirements, as of right development, onerous numbers that don't fit every town. And we keep saying over and over again, one size does not fit all. You can't do in Easton, which is over 70% watershed, what you can do in other places that are higher density or have more space or not as developed. So, you know, we wish we saw more thoughtful bills getting out there.
And to your point, SB 1141, the so-called Looney Bill, is just a retread verbatim of a bill that failed last year, HB 5429. Why even reintroduce something that was rejected a year ago?
Exact question, which we don't have answers to.
Are they purposely not trying to get stuff passed?
Well, I think they hope that fatigue sets in, and we're pretty tenacious, if you haven't noticed. So we don't give up that easily. And you know, like we can just talk right for one second about off-street parking. Every town is not the same. So if you're going to put in a bill that says you're required no off-street parking, let's say, and you've got towns that have very narrow roads versus other towns that have wide roads, that might work in a wide road town where you could just put all parking on the street. It won't work in some other communities. And so when they passed a bill 2 years ago that had an opt-in, actually it had an opt-out for parking, trying to like limit parking in the entire state. And in WestCog, the Western Council of Government, those towns, all except two of them, opted out. And that included cities, included the suburbs, included the rural area. So you have to realize that one-size policy is not going to work. So stop putting out bad ideas that are not workable for communities. And let's work together. Let's incorporate the stakeholders, the shareholders, the experts who know why every community is not the same.
Yeah, we live in an aspirational society where, you know, our local towns are capable of determining and meeting our own community needs and goals and objectives. And these bills don't recognize that. You know, and I want to impress upon people who are listening that, you know, the lawmakers work for us. And if we don't tell them, you know, what we want, if bills are not going to work for our towns, we need to tell them. Because, again, they work for us, and we are the people that you know, hire them, and we can also fire them.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should remember that. I'm pretty sure this audience is pretty aware who the boss is, and it's time to exert some control. My guests are Alexis Harrison of Fairfield and Maria Weingarten of New Canaan from the grassroots group CT 169 Strong. All right, so let's talk about the governor's bill, SB 985. You like some parts of this thing, the opt-in option as opposed to being told and forced what to do. What do you like about the bill? What do you not like about it?
Well, we like the fact that it is, as you mentioned, that you can opt in to it, and you can choose as a town to or a municipality to do that. So if you have, let's say, a development you want to do, it's on one side of a track, and then the other side of the track is where the actual station is, and you would need a pedestrian crosswalk. This is sort of the opportunity to maybe have the state step in to help with creating that pedestrian walk that would get, you know, to be able to develop in an area that you otherwise would not really be able to. It wouldn't be transit friendly because you would have to walk 2 miles to get over to where you can get to the train station. So there are good opportunities in this bill. However, again, they ask you to give up and have as a right development in there. They ask for no parking at all. And the most egregious, and I think Alexis can talk more about this, is that they take away all land use development approvals in favor of Zoning Board of Appeals, which is just it's just not the right body from a town's perspective to do that sort of authorization.
Yeah, and we have to remember, zoning is more than just affordable housing. You know, land use controls, we're your first line of defense when it comes to environmental protection. You know, has anyone heard of climate change? I mean, that's pretty important right now. You know, it's about balance and orderly growth. It's about preventing congestion, protecting property values. And again, you know, we in Connecticut have always cherished home rule. We don't have, you know, county government. And the fact that this bill would mute, you know, TPZ commissioners, it would mute, you know, people who want to come to a public hearing and speak for or against an application, is very troubling to me. And quite frankly, I think we should all be appalled at that notion.
Yeah, you know, listen, this is definitely one of these issues. And again, just looking at some of these other bills, HB 6781 mandates towns address equity in housing and social assets for their communities. Again, that one size fits all. And this one actually mentioned centralizing vouchers, which this bill does not do. And some months ago, talking to Jacqueline Rabe Thomas from the Connecticut Mirror, we were talking about the voucher program in Connecticut. And you can't go town to town with these vouchers. So people get a voucher and they're like, oh, great, this is the answer to my prayers. They go only to find out that there's no affordable housing in their town and they can't use it anywhere else. So, you know, again, these bills, I kind of see what they're trying to do. But as you guys said, you know, one size fits all is not the way. I guess that's where you came up with the name CT169 Strong. We're all different.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'd also say, you know, many of our towns, I know in Fairfield, New Canaan, and many other cities, you know, we've all taken measures over the years to promote affordable housing, whether it's through, you know, the creation of inclusionary housing zones or affordable housing trust funds. You know, we are doing the work. And unfortunately, a lot of lawmakers, you know, have kind of pitted the suburbs against the cities, which is, you know, very unfortunate. You know, we're all one state. We all want to succeed. We all want the best for people. And unfortunately, it's just become, you know, this unfortunate, you know, us against them.
It's interesting because when you look at a lot of the people who've been testifying, one of the common go-to lines has been, well, you're from, you know, whatever town, and your town only has 3%, according to the A30G, affordability. And so it's meant to sort of shame towns. And so we dug down in those numbers a little bit, and when you really look at it, you realize that it's the largest cities that are funded out of the state's coffers to develop affordable there. That's why they have a high percentage, let's say 7% in some larger cities. They don't even have 10% of those. And they're the ones who also get the vouchers in many instances. And they, as to your point, that they can't port them to other places. So they're stuck there. So again, that's why there's 31 towns and or 29, 31 towns that have them right now. And that's because they've set up the system that way. It's a rigged system to measure a 10%, and that's unfortunate that's what they choose to point fingers at other towns with, because they don't. What we've been saying in a lot of our testimony is, well, help us do that. You know, we know it's more expensive sometimes to build affordable, and if we're trying to do that, and we need a little bit of seed funding for that, or some other sort of vouchers or anything else, help us get those so that we can also put out more affordable, if that, you know, and to help create a better, you know, balance of homes in all of the different communities. And so, but again, as an opt-in, not as a you know, a forced measure, and not as a mandate. So, and that's the part that they're really not willing to do. They want a mandate, and they just want to say, go ahead and pay for it yourself.
The website, CT169strong.org. There's also a Facebook group if you're concerned about housing, and you should be. Make sure you join the group. Make sure you check out the website. Alexis Harrison and Maria Weingarten, founders of CT169 Strong, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for talking us through this, and thank you for fighting on our behalf.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you for raising the awareness. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'll be in touch again in the future. We'll track your progress, get you back here, and see how things are going. Big thank you to Alexis Harrison and Maria Weingarten.